This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, everything these days seem to be programmable, from your TV to your phone, you know, even your refrigerator, even living things. Scientists are now looking to alter the genetic code of yeast, bacteria, and even plants to create new organisms with novel functions. Can we build better living through bacteria or yeast? Is synthetic biology the next big disruptive technology? What kinds of new organisms and products could we develop from a little bioengineering? Jeff Buca is the director of the Institute of System Genetics at the New York University's Langone Medical Center here in New York. He joins us here in our CUNY studio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Tim Liu is associate professor in electrical engineering and biological engineering at MIT in Boston. He joins us from MIT. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jeff, to the layman, what is synthetic biology? What do we mean by that?
Well, synthetic biology is an emerging discipline that's a marriage between biologists and engineers, where the attempt is to harness biological science in interesting and practical ways, but also to try to learn more about biological systems by re-engineering them from the ground up.
When you say from the ground up, you mean through their genetic material?
Yes, exactly. So if you take the analogy of a radio is made up of parts, and the parts are soldered together into circuit boards and so on. And similarly, in synthetic biology, you can think of genes as parts, and the parts can be put together into systems that can be programmed to do useful work.
So you can actually make the genes do the work of building for you.
Yes, that's also possible.
And do we give them parts to work with that are not living pieces?
Well,
nanoparticles, things like that?
Well, it is a big and emerging field, so certainly that's a possibility. And our own recent work involves programming, if you will, proteins to do useful work on restructuring chromosomes, synthetic chromosomes.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, so we just finished publishing a paper on the complete synthesis of the first eukaryotic synthetic chromosome. This is a chromosome that was designed on a computer.
This was in yeast?
Yes. But it started out on a computer.
It starts out on a computer.
We start with the normal chromosome sequence.
Right.
It's liken it to a book of 11 chapters, 316,000 letters. And we start with words of 50 to 70 letters in length. Undergraduates in a course that I teach string those together into paragraphs of 750 to 1,000 letters, and then we go on making larger and larger pieces until we put an entire chapter's worth of DNA into the yeast, and we end up with a yeast that's chapter 1 is synthetic, chapters 2 through 11 are native, and then we go on and repeat that process until all 11 chapters are replaced with the sequence we designed on the computer.
So is it a hybrid yeast? Do you call it hybrid?
Well, we would call it semi-synthetic in that one of the chromosomes is synthetic and the other 15 are native.
Mm-hmm. And it goes on and reproduces just like the regular yeast would do?
It's surprisingly yeasty.
until the bread test.
until we add one crucial gene. This is the Cre recombinase, and a special molecule that activates the Cre recombinase that we can add to the culture. And then this leads to a series of, on the one hand, programmed, but on the other hand, random rearrangements or shuffling of the chromosome.
Now, how does this differ from Craig Venter's synthetic chromosome that he made a few years ago?
Well, for one thing, you might be thinking that an organism like yeast has a much larger genome. But in fact, the chromosome that we made is smaller than the piece of DNA that he made several years ago. But what's really different and exciting about it is that it's been so extensively engineered. So although we started with a chromosome of over 316,000 base pairs. We downsized that by about 40,000 base pairs. And in the process of the engineering on the computer, we changed, inserted, or deleted over 50,000 of those DNA letters.
Without affecting the yeast?
Well, according to our tests so far, it behaves an awful lot like yeast. It smells like yeast. It looks like yeast. It grows like yeast.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You would call it the junk DNA, maybe.
We did remove some DNA that is often denigrated as junk, although some of us have built our careers on studying that junk DNA.
Well, I mean, why would nature conserve it if it were junk?
Well,
generation after. Let's get into that later.
That's another story.
Okay, let me get Tim Liu in now. You're a biologist, and Tim Liu is an engineer, right, Tim?
Yeah, by training, I am a biological engineer.
And so you take this sort of information, and you want to make stuff with these kinds of devices that are available, the tools that you have. What kinds of things would you like to make, and do you make with the tools now available to you?
Yeah, so we'd like to actually make materials. We're really inspired by what you see around you in the natural world, trees, bones. You know, these are materials that are made by living cells that incorporate elements of non-living materials. And so we like to leverage the tools of synthetic biology to actually grow materials. And that's a big difference from how we typically think about materials in the modern world, which are generally, made in large factories from the top down from non-living systems. But if we can potentially reprogram biological organisms to actually grow materials and pattern them and form them over multiple length scales, that may give us an ability to make new materials or make materials in a more environmentally friendly way.
So, for example, I understand you work with biofilms. This is the same stuff as the soap scum in the shower, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. We like to work with biofilms and, conventionally, biofilms are thought of as a bad thing because in certain cases, they can lead to infections or, for example, plaque on your teeth is an example of a biofilm as well. But, biofilms are present in our natural world. They're an abundant lifestyle for bacteria. And in many cases, these biofilms are doing useful and interesting things. And so we like to harness the ability of biofilms to build communities and build materials for us.
So tell me what kinds of things you can do with a biofilm now.
So far, we in our recent paper that we published, we basically modified the biofilm so that it would be able to capture non-living materials like gold particles or quantum dots, and it would allow you to basically arrange these materials into linear chains or control the amount of one material versus the other. And this allowed us essentially to make things like a conductive switch where the biofilm would essentially switch on or switch off depending on whether it detected a certain environmental signal and allow you to conduct electricity.
Mm-hmm. So you basically took E. coli, right, and you hacked it. I mean, for lack of a term that public will understand, you hacked the E. coli, made it do things that it doesn't normally do.
That's right, and I think this goes to what Jeff was mentioning earlier. We're really interested in introducing novel functionalities into these organisms, and so you can take the approach, for example, what Jeff has done. I kind of analogize to rewriting the operating system of the yeast organism, and for us, what we've really been doing is kind of like introducing a new app into E. coli. We've written in a relatively small genetic program that allows us to introduce a new function into the organism.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the next step? I mean, is this sort of a proof of concept that you've done here?
Yeah, so this is a proof of concept. I think there's a lot of potential directions to go into. One of the really interesting things about biological systems is they have the ability to remodel themselves or self-heal. So imagine, when you break your bone, the bone can heal itself again. So, we don't have materials in the real world that are like that. But imagine if you had a material that, had cells that were embedded in them, and these cells could have the ability to sense and respond to what happens in the environment and even repair the materials. That's kind of our long-term vision for the work.
And Jeff, what do you think? What do you think of this work here?
Well, I think...
Does it scare you at all?
Oh, no, not at all. One of the things I absolutely love about this field is it's brought together two completely different cultures. Engineers like Tim, who fundamentally believe anything can be engineered if you have enough information, and somewhat more skeptical biologists like me who wonder whether the cells are really going to cooperate 100% of the time. And this injects this wonderful creative tension in the field that just makes it a really exciting place to be right now and to be working in.
Let me go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Oakland. Matt in Oakland, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
Your guest seemed to be very excited about the work they're doing now and the possibilities of, you know, all the different things that they can do with genetic engineering on biological systems. But aren't they concerned about future unintended consequences of the work they're doing now? You know, either both, you know, either one getting out of control, or two, future work based on what they're doing now, like mm-hmm. that could lead to, for example, Brave New World scenario.
All right, good question. Let me go to both my guests here. Let me go to Jeff first. What do you think? Are we walking over a line here, or being should be more careful, or?
Right. So this is definitely something I think our community takes very seriously. We, in our project, for example, have a card-carrying bioethicist who's a member of our project. We take safety considerations very seriously. We work with a strain of yeast that's engineered in such a way that it won't multiply well in the wild. We also have numerous colleagues around the world that we're collaborating with on this project, and we make them sign off on a statement of principles that we will exercise caution and try to be responsible scientists.
Mm-hmm. Tim, are you fearful that something, you know, might crawl, get out? You're working with E. coli. It's everywhere. That kind of E. coli is ubiquitous.
Yeah, so I agree with Jeff. This is something that you know, the community takes very seriously in terms of our responsibility to not only to do good work, but also to the rest of society. And so, you know, we definitely take precautions in terms of the types of organisms that we work with. So we work with a, you know, strain of E. coli that is essentially, you know, much less fit than its wild type brethren, and we work, and it has no pathogenic properties associated with it. And we're working this in a lab setting. There's no, you know, environmental release of this material at this point. And so it's an area that I think, you know, as a community we value very much. I think at all the major conferences and even at the undergraduate level, you know, with these undergraduate competitions that come around every year, where students are actually building new synthetic biology projects, you know, this is a major focus all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an area that the community is taking very seriously.
Do you think, as Jeff says, that as an engineer, you really, you know, there's no boundaries of stuff that you might be able to do? What do you think the upper limits are to what synthetic biology can do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think currently we're really limited by, you know, we haven't really seen where the limitations are. You know, we're limited by certain aspects of the technology. I mean, it's taken a while to get to the point where we can make lots of DNA precisely. And so we haven't really been able to test all of the different ideas that people have. And so, you know, I think at this point, we're really just starting to explore what the boundaries are. And that's why the field is so exciting, because people can come in with different new ideas and really take a shot to see whether we can implement them.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about synthetic biology with Tim Liu, associate professor at MIT, and Jeff Buca, who is at NYU Langone Medical Center here. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people would like to talk about it. Let's go to Stephanie in Cincinnati. Hi, Steph.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, I was just wondering, what makes this different than, this is for the researcher that did the yeast, what makes this different than what we've already done, you know, splicing genes into bacteria? Like, I remember making, you know, bacteria glow and college. So what makes this different, it being a yeast?
Right. So I think there are two big differences. One, a yeast is, although it's a microorganism like the bacteria you were describing, it's more closely related to humans, animals, and plants. And therefore, the basic things that make yeast cells tick are particularly relevant to our understanding of what makes human, plant, and animal cells tick. So for this reason, there's been a tremendous investment by organizations like the National Institutes of Health and so on in studying yeast, and we know an enormous amount about it. Mm-hmm. That's one difference. And the other major difference, of course, is the scale on which we're doing this. We're not just putting one gene in, but we're putting in an entire chromosome with hundreds to thousands of genes as we get into the bigger chromosomes.
Why not? Thanks for calling, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Well, can you get a full chromosome in there soon? The full genome?
Full genome.
Full genome in there?
Well, we think we're 2 or 3 years away from completing all of the other chromosomes. We have the funding for 15 out of the 16 in hand. Mm-hmm. There are people working around the world in Edinburgh, in London, in China, and soon we'll be joined by colleagues in Singapore and Australia to get this huge job done, but several of the other chromosomes are well on their way to completion.
If you get the full chromosome, the full genome, where's the definition of life then?
Well, we're not creating life here. I want to make that point very strongly here. As Tim said, what we're really doing is switching out the operating system for a newer model. And we start with living yeast cells. It's not like we mix a bunch of chemicals together and out froths a brand new organism that previously wasn't there. We're just switching out the DNA.
It's in the nucleus.
Yes.
So that's what the caller asked, what's the difference between the bacteria and the yeast cells?
Right, that's one of the
differences. There's a nucleus and
the
setup of the DNA and all that kind of stuff.
Right, and the DNAs are linear as opposed to circular in the bacteria. There's a whole series of differences, fundamental differences in the biology.
Mm. Also, it's sort of, so you're swapping out just the genetic material, and everything else stays in the cell.
Right, so the proteins that package the DNA and the enzymes that copy it and all of that are already in that cell. Mm-hmm. They eventually get replaced by new copies that are specified by the new code that we put in.
When does a yeast stop being a yeast?
Well, that's another really interesting question that we think we might have some new ways of looking at with the scrambling of the genome. How much scrambling of the genome does it take to create a new species, for example?
Right.
It might still seem quite yeast-like, but it might not be able to reproduce by mating with normal yeast. And so then by the definition of the biological definition of a species, it would be considered a new species.
Hmm. We'll come back and talk lots more about that, take some more questions. Our number 844-724-8255 is our number if you want to talk about synthetic biology. And you can also tweet us. Yeah, tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. And when we come back, we'll talk maybe with I'm going to ask Tim, how do these bacteria actually pick up these nanoparticles? Where do they hang on? What happens to them? When does a bacterium no longer become a bacterium and it's doing work to do something else? Interesting questions, I think. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about synthetic biology with my guests, Jeff Buca of NYU Langone Medical Center in New York, Tim Liu at MIT in Massachusetts. Our number is 844-724-8255. You said before, Tim, that it's like introducing an app into the cell. I mean, at one point I asked this before of Jeff, at what point do you have to call it something else because it no longer resembles the original?
Yeah, I think I think Jeff answered it quite well in that it really comes down to what the semantics of what a different species is. And so like in the case of yeast, you can define the species as something that no longer can mate with the natural yeast. In the bacterial system, we're not making that much of a modification. We're essentially inserting a couple of new circuits into the cell that essentially get the cell to be able to capture materials or do new things, but we're not really changing the inherent behavior or function of the rest of the bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, I think another approach that we and others are taking is to move entire pathways from organism A into organism B. So, for example, you might take a whole metabolic pathway from human cells and introduce it into the yeast and then get rid of all the corresponding yeast genes. So now, is that Saccharomyces cerevisiae or isn't it?
Give me an example of what kind of thing.
Well, so for example, we're working on all of the genes that specify the synthesis of adenine, the letter A of DNA. Mm-hmm. And this is quite a number of genes. And we are slowly moving the genes over one by one from human onto this specialized chromosome. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that they can substitute quite well for the yeast, and it still seems very yeasty.
Still make bread with it.
Well, we haven't done that experiment. But I bet it would make good bread.
Would it still make the adenine?
It definitely still makes the adenine. The yeast grow without the adenine. That's the test.
Okay, so then now you got me thinking. So now you can make a yeast that also makes something else in the bread.
Yes.
So it might be able to have a product out of this that enhances the flavor of the bread or some other kinds of, something like that?
As a matter of fact, one of our iGEM teams in years past made a yeast that produced beta carotene, an orange precursor to vitamin A, which is in short supply in many parts of the world. And we proposed that potentially this could be distributed in places where there's vitamin A deficiency, much like the golden rice idea.
Right.
So that's certainly doable.
Where did that go, that idea?
Well, it's still out there.
Still out there.
Yeah, it could be done.
Mm-hmm. Tim, tell us about your bacteria. How do they latch on to the non-living stuff that you give? I'm thinking of the nanoparticles, for example. What do with them?
Yeah, these bacteria have these really interesting extracellular appendages. They're kind of like hair on the outside of the bacteria. And they basically form these nanofibers that you can modify to express peptides, basically short sequences of amino acids. And these essentially act as little hooks to grab onto nanoparticles. So you can design peptides that will essentially just attract the nanoparticle or really just bind covalently to a nanoparticle. And so this is a way of basically interfacing the biological system with non-living materials and using it to capture those materials in a way that you want them to.
Now, with E. coli, they live all over our intestinal tracts. They're everywhere inside our bodies. What kinds of things could you help our bodies do with it? Because now the E. coli can do something else also.
Yeah, so I think E. coli can be modified in a lot of ways to aid in human health. As you mentioned, people are looking at engineering E. coli to deliver therapeutic molecules in the gut. You can also imagine we have some projects going on where we're trying to engineer E. coli as a sensor for the intestinal tract. So imagine making an E. coli that could detect whether you have bleeding in the gut or you have some pathogen in the gut or you have some early signs of colon cancers. These could all be different ways of using these modified bacteria to improve human health.
Mm-hmm. It is a brave new world, isn't it, Jeff?
I think we're going to see some really positive outcomes from this with potentially nutraceuticals and other products that aren't traditional drugs necessarily, but could have a pretty immediate impact on human health.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Jeff Buca is director of the Institute of System Genetics at the NYU Langone Medical Center here in New York. Tim Liu, associate professor, electrical engineering and biological engineering at MIT. Thank you. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.